Our Dharma talk tonight will be given by Dharma holder Diane Shoshin Fitzgerald.
Thank you, everyone, for holding this coming and going sesshin with your practice and your many activities in support of it. It is really a remarkable opportunity that I don't think is duplicated in any other Zen center that I know of, and so very perfect for people with busy 21st century lives. And some of you are here for the duration, some for some time, some are coming and going. Some years I have been here for the entire sentence. Others, I was granted parole. And this year, because of other commitments, I am more on the going side than the coming side. But I think of you all throughout the day, sitting here and holding this practice in the depth of winter makes it seem especially poignant and really touching. And I do listen to the talks, and I thank Steve for putting them up there. So many people are sitting with you far away, listening to the talks, and with your great spirit. And in thinking about this coming and going aspect of this sesshin, I was kind of tickled when I read a line from this first section of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which says, "There is nowhere to come or to go." There is nowhere to come or to go. And I have been sitting with that a bit. Nowhere to come or to go. It is, it's quite mysterious, isn't it? Because obviously, there is much coming and going here and in life, each moment coming and going, all of our lives coming and going. And yet there is this teaching, there is nowhere to come or to go. This little snippet is much of how I find myself practicing Zen, that I have read a great many books. I have shelves of them, and I have listened to many Dharma talks, and at this point I have given quite a few Dharma talks, and I don't remember any of them. I only remember these little snippets that come into my mind as gifts from the universe, really. So another one that came to me today is that when you are alone, be as with you are with everyone. And when you are with everyone, be as if you are alone. So these little jewels of the practice somehow get embedded in my brain and seem to come out when I need them. So this one in particular came to me today. There is nowhere to come or to go. And recently someone was asking me to teach them about Zen, and I started reflecting on what do I know to teach them. And it feels like I only know two things. One is how to sit, and I don't really know it, but my body does. It knows how to get down on these well-worn cushions and to sit upright and dignified. And Melissa and David both gave very beautiful talks about this posture that we assume, this sa-zen, that is the heart of not only our practice here, but the heart of our practice in and outside of this lovely temple. And then I thought the second thing that I know and is how to bow. And I don't know this perfectly, and again, it is more that my body knows it than my mind knows it, but bowing many times over these years, I have found that my body will just bow at the sound of the bell. And in Zen, we bow constantly to each other, to the Buddha. And you'll find maybe when you leave the sesshin that you are reflexively bowing to people in the grocery store. It just comes natural. And so I was delighted that Suzuki Roshi has a chapter here on bowing. And what he says is, bowing is a very serious practice. You should be prepared to bow even in your last moment. Even though it is impossible to get rid of our self-centered desires, we have to do it. Our true nature wants us to. Our true nature wants us to bow. I think when people first come to Zen, at least some students I have been with, don't find bowing all that comfortable. This is something that doesn't come naturally to especially maybe American Zen students. We question things like bowing to a graven image or bowing to each other as maybe kind of precious or kind of superfluous. But I was happy to read also that Suzuki Roshi loved the way American Zen students questioned everything, keeping the practice alive. So wonderful to encounter someone who questions this bowing. And for me, the bowing changes when instead of it being bowing to, it is just bowing or bowing with. And Suzuki says, usually to bow means to pay our respects to something which is more worthy of respect than ourselves. But when you bow to Buddha, you should have no idea of Buddha. You should just become one with Buddha. To bow to Buddha, you should have no idea of Buddha. You should just become one with Buddha. And so it is not to you that I bow. It is not to the Buddha on the altar that I bow. It is not to the snowflakes this morning that I bow. It is just snowflakes, just us, just Buddha, just the hands coming together and the bending at the waist, and maybe all the way down to the floor, and the head touches the floor, and the hands rise up beside the ears, and then up we go again, over and over. And this bowing, it can be done without even physically bowing, right? Imagine at the end of your life, as Suzuki is suggesting, even in your last moment, be prepared to bow. So maybe in your last moment, there's no possibility of getting up, or maybe even no possibility of bringing the hands together palm to palm. But there is a way to bow, right? We all know this. It is truly our nature expressing itself in this impulse to bow. There was a contemporary of Suzuki Roshi, Uchiyama Roshi, Kosho Uchiyama Roshi. And on the day he died, he wrote a poem in his diary called Just Bow. And in the notes in his diary, he said he finally felt that this expressed what he had wished to say and write his entire life of practice. And this is how it goes. Putting my right and left hands together as one, I just bow. Just bow to become one with Buddha. Just bow to become one with everything I encounter. Just bow to become one with all the myriad things. Just bow as life becomes life. It's just bowing, this place of not knowing, this place of acknowledging our deep connection with each other, with all of life. From this comes this true nature that wants to bow. I was talking with someone from my Sangha in Down East Maine who lives in Miami in the wintertime, and he was talking about how groups of people from his neighborhood had decided that it was time to get out and start to meet each other. And they went out into the street and they went door to door and they brought people out face to face with each other in person, feeling the urgency of expressing their connection. And in this, as in so many things, there is just bowing. Just bowing to our human frailty, our need for connection, and that there is nothing other than us as the whole universe bowing together. There is nowhere to come or to go, only bow. Thank you.
Well, please make yourselves comfortable, and we'll have our Dharma dialogue. In the Dharma dialogue, this is an opportunity for you to ask questions or make comments about practice, about the talk, about bowing or coming and going.
These Dharma talks that you've given, that it comes down to what you would teach to someone is how to sit and how to bow. Yeah. I just really think that's really incredible.
Mm. Or a testament to my early dementia. Thank you. Yeah. So, you know, when we read something or hear something, of course it's inspiring and, you know, it just feels like we're kind of riding the waves and, you know, just wonderful. But then the words don't really stick, right? Right? I don't know, maybe. It doesn't happen with me. But it is just how we learn to like be in our everyday life, yeah, right? Just the sitting, just the bowing, just the caring, just the laughing, yeah. Thank you.
But and I think too, it's relieving. You know, you hear all these Dharma talks and all this stuff, and you kind of want to hold on, like, oh yeah, that one, yeah, I want to remember that one, and maybe we could just hold on to these two things. Oh, sitting and bowing, I can probably remember that. There were two things. One was
I'm the easy teacher.
Diane, thank you so much for coming, and thank you for your lovely talk. I was struck by multiple things, but the two that I'll mention are, I loved when you said, brought forth this, I don't have to, mind doesn't have to know how to sit or how to bow, because body knows how. Mm-hmm. You know, in this time and in my life, you know, the mind was the, you know, this is the thing that is, that knows what to do and figures everything, you know, and I have recently experienced this, what I call body memory. Mm-hmm. We had some renovation in our house. We had to move some things. And even after it just being moved for even a day, I found that I kept going there to find that thing, even though for 30 plus years it had been in another place. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, such a fast connection in the body for where, you know, how to move. And so when you said that, I thought, wow, what something to sink into, of just knowing that nothing I have to really grasp with my cognitive mind of like how to bow, how to sit. and I think that tied beautifully to the many things that you said about bowing. And the thing that came up for me was around this, I call it this sort of giving over. Mm-hmm. Or this surrendering, or there are different words. None of them seem quite right, but my phrase in my mind is giving over of ourselves. Mm-hmm. When we bow, just sort of, you know, it's in my life anyway, so used to trying to be in charge and control and arrange and fix, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. you know, and this sort of.
And such a relief, right, when we don't have to be in charge of it.
And
we can just bow, and we can just sit, and we don't have to be Laura or Diane. Just, you know. Thank you.
Christine?
Yes, I've definitely been transformed around bowing. When I first got here, I thought it was quite excessive.
I'm not even sure how to remember where to bow and when to bow.
And now, just over time, I feel that surrender and that reverence that you're, and just that quality in the bowing of giving over and honor. I mean, I can't even find the words for it. I mean, you said it so well, and so did you, Diane. But I have found myself in places and just bowing. So people look at me quizzically, and I'm like, oh, I don't even know what to say. Just let's just move on. You know, I don't even say anything. I just, you know, move on to the next thing. And of course, it was awkward, so they move on.
It is interesting, along with Buddha figures, how bowing has crept into popular culture. Mm-hmm. And now you'll see people put their palms together as some kind of reverence. It's I think people don't quite know what it means, but there's something in that seems appropriate.
Yeah. If you watch any awards show now on television for any, you know, for acting, music, people bow when they get the, it's like, where did that just crept in, as you said, just a few years back I started seeing that. It is a universal, and it's somehow taken on a Western aspect now.
It's like the Buddha figures at TJ Maxx.
Yes.
Just a decorative element.
Sneaking in. This practice is very subversive.
Mike.
You had alluded to some other Dharma talks and some other, but I love listening to yours because it's so Diane.
I bow to you.
That was a very Mike comment. Yeah. There is something really true about the practice, though, that that we express ourselves. You know, there is this this idea that we're all separate from each other and unique and also all one. The reality is that both are true. You know, we can't help expressing who we are all the time, although that changes and ebbs and flows. But there's something identifiable about it and something that we can really appreciate. You know, that that nobody makes comments like you. Nobody makes comments like Christine. Nobody gives Dharma talks like Diane. Thank goodness. You know, that that we do have this wonderful variety that all blends together. Reminds me of an orchestra. You know, where it's a symphony where every element is contributing to the whole. And I think we get in trouble when we try to be like somebody else. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to be more like Diane, so you know, that would be a, probably a real failure of a Dharma talk. I'm going to give a Diane-style Dharma talk. And one thing that David and I say a lot is that our students don't sound like us, which I think is also part of the whole thing. They sound like themselves.
Mm-hmm. And I think so important, one of the reasons we do this Dharma dialogue so that each voice can come forward, and when we listen, we hear the Buddha speaking in the form of, and when we have different people up here, Julie, was Julie this morning speaking. She had no choice. Yeah. even if we would, and often we would like to be. but to see this, because we can't actually know who we are. You know, if you try to be yourself, you'll be a pale imitation. Oh, I would be David. Oh, what is what would David, you know?
I don't know.
Okay, I think I'm getting it. So we have to trust that if we come forward with no choice, if we come forward, I'd like to have something more erudite and whatever, but this is what I have. Mm-hmm. And we can begin to see what a gift it is when we come forward as our miserable self and offer it with generosity.
Mm-hmm. And there's some connection to what you were saying, Laura, about this trusting, you know, that coming forth, as we do in the Dharma Dialogue and those of us who give talks, it's not exactly we who are coming forth. So there's definitely Diane gives a talk and it sounds like Diane, but it isn't really Diane doing it, you know, that. And it is like finding the furniture. It just we know how to do that. It's so amazing. When you were talking, I was thinking, we travel a lot, and I'll be in a hotel room and, you know, maybe have to get up to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night. My body just knows how to get out of the bed. It's not my bed. And I know how to get to the bathroom. I've never been in this room before. Sometimes I have trouble finding the light. But, you know, that it's just amazing that I learn it so quickly. And yet it's not really me learning it. My body, I don't have to worry so much. I don't have to do all this work. Jillian, you had your hand.
The little tidbit that you remember from somewhere of when you're, I'm probably going to say it wrong, but when you come into a room, or like when you're with people, you're alone. When you're alone, you're with everyone. And also this whole talk about like who we are, who we think we are, we don't know who we are, and this being in charge thing, and you know, it's a strange thing to just be on the way and that it starts happening and you have all these people in your life and it's this strange relief and this strange topsy-turvy thing, almost like some transplant, like if you transplant a plant, it's still totally alive. Or if you divide it out, you know, host a plant or something, you take that shovel and it's not drastic. I don't mean to be drastic like that, I'm not trying to. But it's like nothing is really changing.
Yeah, but it does. But sorry.
Yeah.
And it completely changes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Looks the same, but no.
Being with people and being alone has been such a this weird conflictual thing, because I tend to, even now I'm doing it, like I have this like energy and I don't really understand it, and I think I need to understand it, and I think I need to harness it, and it needs to go a certain way, and I'm really just, I end up just being a clown, kind of, you know, because I think something, I think I have to do something with it. Mm-hmm. And so it's been amazing to just have so many stretches of time, or, you know, like, and I'm not, and it just doesn't happen. It's not like I'm choosing not to. It's almost like this strange unsubscribing or something. Or I don't know what it is. I'm not even going to say what it is.
Well, and I think, yeah, I think that when we practice, we encounter this kind of disorganization that is both a relief that we don't have to be the one we thought we were, but also challenging. How do we, when it's all changing and it's not changing, and when we're alone and we're together, some of the familiar guideposts aren't there. And it requires great courage to trust this. And in a sense, we have to navigate new terrain. And I think the teaching is every moment we have to navigate new terrain to really be here. That this is life. This both can be terrifying and wonderful and precious and all of that together. So quite a thing to be walking this path of liberation.
I'm glad you both gave voice to that, because that is when the rug gets pulled out, you know, there is some nervousness maybe, you know, like all of a sudden we want our rug back, you know. So how do we work with that, you know? It's a good thing to reflect on.
Thank you, Diane. I was just reflecting on what Suzuki Roshi said, you know, no coming and no going.
Mm-hmm.
And bowing, you know, so bowing is a very, very important practice. And he appreciates the questioning of the student around us, like, what is this? You know?
Mm-hmm.
So just something in there I really appreciate about it's a big deal and not a big deal, you know. So to work with bowing, and let go whatever that meaning is, you know, whatever arises, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the stories, you know, it's amazing how bowing can create stories.
Yeah.
You know, just
mm-hmm. yeah.
endless
mm-hmm.
stories. Well, I don't like bowing. Well, I love bowing.
Yeah, watch this one. I'm really going to nail this one.
I'm not bowing as well as he's bowing.
Yeah, right. Much better than her.
So I like how Suzuki Roshi talked about that, and it seems like that is what Zen practice is a lot of times about poking us in ways, you know, like or trying to, you know. And so I don't know, just appreciating that.
Yeah. Poking us to like the pin in the balloon. Yeah, right.
In the compassionate way.
Yeah.
but I think it's so important to see how the little self will use everything. It's so creative. It will, you know, so then bowing becomes something we can be proud of or be ashamed of or, and to notice that, that's not bad, it's just what happens. So how do we give up the bowing as we bow?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Peter?
I experienced a little bit of this minute to minute during the walking meditation. This is my first time here, and when we started the slow walking meditation, I kind of got into a nice rhythm and it felt familiar, and you know, I was kind of on automatic pilot. And then they switched it up where they started going up the stairs. And that was like, oh, what's this? And then another time it was like double time and my feet weren't quite sure what to do. So I like the fact that there was a lot of variety that kind of woke me up to the fact that, you know, you just, the automatic pilot doesn't work all the time.
For those of you who don't know what Peter's referring to, at the coming and going session in the afternoons, it's snowy and wintry out, and we have to do our fast walking inside. So people are very creative and go up and down the stairs and all around and change directions. And it's kind of fun. So if you want to just come for that, that happens around mid-afternoon. About 3:30. Yeah, 3:30. Yeah, Mara.
I was really rebellious when I came here with the bowing. I thought, if I bow, then other people are bowing. What else will I do? So I chose to investigate it. And what I loved about this was that, Diane, you were the one that I investigated it with. And so to have this talk now kind of brings it all together. And I was like, I'm going to see, you know, why, I'm going to ask why she bows. I want to understand this. I'm going to ask why I should bow or why other people bow. I really want to know personally why you do. And so, you know, you give me your reasons. And what I loved is that you told me I didn't have to bow. And in that moment, I decided that I would try it. There was like this space that was created for me to find it. And it was like this rebellious kind of teenager thing that I was feeling. But like, all right, so I don't have to, but maybe I'm a little curious. So it was just so special tonight to have you come in and give this talk about it. You were the first teacher that I really ever inquired with about anything, the first time I talked with the teacher. So it kind of came really full circle for me. So
thank you. And you should know that many great Zen teachers start out as tigers, and then they turn into cats. So you may find. Yeah.
So I loved your talk. Thank you so much. A couple of things really struck me. And I can't remember the words. And here's that, you know, wanting the words back. The heart wants to bow, or something wants to bow. And that just struck me. And the bowing at the moment of death. And I just had this sense of, what a gift, life. And struck by the voices that I've heard in this room. I have to say, I feel like a bell. Mm-hmm. And here I have the chance to really feel the resonances and the vibrations. Mm-hmm. And, like, and of course, my mind goes like, wish I could do that when I'm not here.
Wonderful. Thank you.
And I love so much you quoted Suzuki Roshi. That's a very important line to me about when you're alone. What is it?
Norman Fisher.
Yeah, I was Norman Suzuki, Fisher. But I was just saying this is one of the snippets that stay in my mind. Is that when you're so when you're alone, be as if you were with others, and when you are with others, be as if you are alone. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So wonderful practice in the context of a sesshin, because we do have moments when we are alone and when we're with others, and how do we weave that together? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll practice a little bit, take a few breaths, and then move into the rest of it.